gap out of it. Let's assume there is no gap. As when the 10 years expires, then the creditor can take the land. Is that it?
Well, if I were on the board of directors and I was approaching the 10-year period, I would make sure nothing expired. I would just slap the 5 years on top of it.
Well, under the law as it stands now, when you've slapped your 5 years on top, is that the end?
No, you can keep going. Am I saying this good, Roland? Both Roland and Glenn, who are agreeing with me, that the extension, although it's for a term, you can add terms.
Do you want to speak into the mic, Roland? Roland Shanks?
I said the real question would probably be whether there's a positive motion needed to maintain the land in the land bank, and if you'd already had a takeover or a bankruptcy situation or something like that, the corporation may be unable to make that positive move to keep it in the land bank.
You mean that if your corporation goes into bankruptcy and the trustee in bankruptcy is running the corporation, he isn't going to renew the land bank?
Might be. I would guess that.
It might be a breach of his duties to the creditors, one would think.
There's also a couple other problems that have come up in context with the land bank. One is, and I think that this has pretty much been resolved, but there, early on, there appeared to be maybe a states' rights issue brewing with the federal government essentially usurping taxing authority of the state of Alaska and adverse possession and some of these other things which the state has held very dear as being state issues. I think that's been turned back. I think the state has now seen that this is a good thing. But it is a problem that could come up again in the future. There's a potential that there's going to be a state version of the land bank introduced in next year's legislature, which will not only offer a state version, but will affirm the federal version to take care of any of those kind of problems. And one thing that just occurred to me while listening to this whole scenario that could be almost the world's worst scenario, and that would be that a corporation put their land in the land bank to protect it from being lost, and in fact had a serious takeover bid brought against them, and because their land is in the land bank and it can't be pledged or alienated, they have absolutely nothing to go to the bank with to try and get money to hold off and defend against the takeover. So they could essentially be tying their hands to defend themselves against the takeover by trying to protect their own land. It's kind of a real desperate catch-22. Yeah, but you'd have to pay all the back taxes. And if you pulled it out in the...
The taxes you pay, as I understand it, is if you develop part of that land bank.
Well,
that's correct.
Well, yeah, but nobody's done it yet, and I'm not sure...
The land bank system is no good anyway.
Well, Glenn, you're speaking with great conviction. And
why would I give, as a native... For 200 years, we've been fighting to get our land, and then we turn around and give it back to the federal government. That's asinine.
That's the basic.
Yeah. Rosemary Maher and then Gary Anders.
I agree with Glenn. I have some old files. My father was the secretary of the village council and back in 1959, and I read through the old files. And one of the letters that he wrote said, Dear Secretary of Interior, we, the native people of Northway, would like to keep our land that we hunt and fish and subsist for subsistence. And he drew a map around the area he wanted and said we would like the federal government and the state government to stay out, and we would like to prevent non-native people from getting homesteads, and signed it and sent it off. And to me, that was the basic concept of the Alaska Native Land Claims, was to keep the land for the people as they used it. And it got all blown out of proportion. And I think I agree with Glenn that I don't like the Alaska Native Land Bank, and as a village corporation president, you know, I would be against this resolution. And I don't have a solution, but I do think that that the reason for the land claims was to keep the land for the native people and their uses. And I think the best solution is would be to transfer it to the IRAs. And I've had bad experience with the land bank. I've tried to deal with them and I gave up. Ghana, you got to them first, so I didn't carry it any further. But I totally agree with Glenn.
Yeah, David and Gary. Sorry, Gary.
I'm confused. It seems like we're talking about corporations as a homogeneous unit, when in fact there may or may not be conflicts of interest between regional corporations that have subsurface title and village corporations that have surface title. With regard to the deposit of land in the land bank, who does that and who can withdraw it? It seems that you have developmental issues regarding the use rights of both surface and subsurface estates. And I'm not sure if when a village corporation nominates lands for the lands bank, whether or not that means that the regional corporation can't explore for oil and gas associated with that. You know, I think you have a real thorny issue determining what's developed and what's not developed. It seems that you know, there are so many problems here that have to be thought out that you know, they ought to appreciate some clarification.
Thank you, Gary. David Case.
I don't have much clarification, but as to what's developed and non-developed, there is a new state statute that rather meticulously defines that, and Roland probably knows better what it means than I do. I've just read it. He lives with it, I suppose. But it has the mark of having been thought through. And I'll leave it at that. Maybe we want to elaborate on it.
Yeah, Bart Garber.
Yeah, why don't you go ahead and try it first, Roland? I mean, there is one provision in ANCSC already that says at least for exploration purposes that won't be deemed a development of land. But, I mean, how far you go in exploration before, well, we're exploring because we drilled a well, but we only drilled one, and that's still exploration. It was a test hole. I don't know. This is where you get into the definition of the state law. And just because something's been thought on doesn't determine who thought about it. So, you know, that'll determine the depth of it. As far as the surface, subsurface, and who gets to deem it, that's a new one for me. And if someone else could maybe bring in, this may be an application to see what is the scope of 14F about when the village allegedly has the right to determine when land will be developed, where then you've got regional corporations coming in telling us that there's this long-term theory of common law rights to access subsurface minerals that comes in conflict with that. So maybe it's a time to determine, you know, the 14F question. What is the scope of that right, and when it has to do with land bank decisions? I don't know. That may be a position where a village may be able to negotiate to say that, region, if you do develop, you will assume the tax liability that you give us. And maybe there's a way to negotiate it. So it's just not an either-or question again. I like to avoid those.
Rosemary Maher and then Roland Shanks.
On the 14F issue, I don't know if you're aware that there was an effort made between the regional and the village corporations specifically to gravel, and it got into the 14F, and things fell apart. The villages and the regions couldn't communicate, they couldn't agree, so we just dropped it. And I think on the 14F, if you have lots of money, then we can address the issue.
I was on the board of a village corporation. I'm really aware of that problem. But the subsurface, the gravel issue had to do with ownership and not the ability to get at it. So we haven't gotten to the question of the ability to get at it. We have found out that we don't own, all we own is a surface right. We apparently don't even own the grass we walk on. Maybe that's surface. I don't know. Maybe that's not. Maybe the region owns the roots.
Rosemary, and then Roland, and then Tony.
One more comment on that 14F. When we were meeting with the regional corporations, we tried to tie the 14F in with the gravel, and that's where the negotiations went dead. The regional corporations weren't ready to address the issue, and I think it's probably going to be a legal battle before it's over with. And I have a real problem because I'm on the board of directors of a regional corporation and the president of a village corporation, so I kind of try to stay away from that issue.
Don't go to any meetings. Claude, and then Roland, and then Tony.
Just a little comment. I have to quote my father. When it came down to the purchase by the Village Corporation of gravel from the region, he said he didn't want to buy it. He just wanted to rearrange it.
Roland?
Well, to get back a little bit to a comment that was made just a couple times ago about the state law that defined development, that was in fact developed and put forward by Cook Inlet Region a couple years ago while I was on staff over there.
What was developed?
The amendment dealing with what is developed land.
Oh yeah, right.
And basically what it says is that when land is put in a position and is essentially put on the market to be converted into money, that then it is developed. Up until that point, it's not. Even though the land may be divided into lots and there may be power running in front of it and a road by it, it still isn't developed until you actually put it on the market. And that was to solve a problem that some regions and some villages have, in that they have gotten lands that for one reason or another was subdivided in the past by the state or by, you know, some other situation, and through all sorts of quirks of fate have now come to a region or a village. And also some of the urban villages had a problem in that their land, you know, laid adjacent to a highway, and again, it was not really through any activity of theirs or any kind of desire of theirs to develop the land that lies next to a highway, and we felt that they should not be penalized and taxed because of that. We had a situation on the Kenai Peninsula where the Kenai Borough was saying that the correction lots that BLM uses to correct, it's a surveying technique that they use to correct the number of acres within a township, and the lots that are created by water bodies to use for acreage calculation are in fact lots. They are a subdivision and therefore taxable as being developed. So this law was kind of aimed at heading that off. Anyhow, that's enough background on that. But basically, the state law deals with taxation of land. And while we have kind of shifted it over and used it as the definition under land bank, there is no direct tie in statute between the two. The surface subsurface issue is an issue that was discussed an awful lot. AFN had a work group on the land bank a couple of years ago, and we went through all sorts of scenarios and all sorts of what ifs and what happens now kind of runs. And there was a lot of question about that, and basically, you know, the statute is silent to whether the surface owner can put theirs in separate from the subsurface owner, whether the subsurface owner can put his in separate from the surface owner, whether they have to be joined or what. And we just kind of assumed, and I think particularly the villages in some regions were anxious to assume that since the Congress and its wisdom was silent on whether you had to be a surface or a subsurface owner, that they didn't care. And since they didn't care, we figured we wouldn't care. But that is an issue that will, I'm sure, be a stumbling block to the use of the land bank on down the road. When you have a village that wants to put an area into the land bank, and you have a region that wants to do some development in that area, it's going to be a difficult situation. Mm-hmm. And to speak just briefly to the 14F situation that's been brought up, I don't want to speak too long about it because we're currently in litigation, and even though our regional attorney or our regional corporation's attorney is no longer here, there is pending litigation between Eklutna and Cook Inlet, which involves not only sand and gravel and who owns it, but also 14F and the extent of it. We agree with Claude's dad that we weren't selling it, we were just moving it. And our regional corporation disagreed with where we were moving it to. So hopefully when this litigation comes down, we'll have a better idea of what the rules are and what the whole situation is.
Yeah, Tony Strong.
Yes, I wanted to I thought this discussion would stay a little bit longer with this other issue of change of ownership of a substantial portion of the assets of the corporation and
Well, Tony, I think we have come to that, and can I just say a word and then I'll give you the floor? I think that we should consider the two concrete possibilities that have been raised here. First of all, by Glenn Fredericks, that the land held by a Native corporation is transferred to a cooperative or a nonprofit corporation, and Rose Marie Maher says, or to an IRA. You have those possibilities. And this NANA resolution seems to encompass those. Perhaps I don't quite understand it. So it seems to me the discussion arises out of that. And we might, and I think this is what you're about to come to, what are the rights of the dissenting shareholders? Okay. And the second thing that I want to come to and have people address is taking those three possibilities in turn, co-op, nonprofit, IRA, what protection do you have against corporate failure, against corporate takeover, and against taxation? And so the floor is yours, but I think that's what we are doing now.
Well, I did shake my head no initially when you said dissenters' rights, but I did, actually it does involve dissenters' rights. The scenario I'll put up before the fine legal minds here. What do you do in a situation where say we have a corporation, a village corporation right now owning only the surface rights and regional owning the subsurface rights, the village corporation in trying to fend off failure or trying to get some assets to be able to, or some liquid assets to be able to invest in their operations, have pledged 100% of their land. And their efforts fail. They are now on the verge of Chapter 11 or Chapter 7 bankruptcy. That is a major transfer of assets, so to speak. They didn't need to get the shareholders' permission, as was clearly stated earlier. They didn't need to get shareholder permission to obligate the land. But they went ahead, I mean, to transfer, I mean, they do need to get it for transferring the assets. They don't need it to get to obligate it, to pledge it as collateral. Now, and now we have a situation, using my scenario, now you have a situation where all of the land has been collateralized. The village corporation is on the verge of Chapter 11 or Chapter 7 bankruptcy. And how do you address the dissenters' rights, so to speak? Do the dissenters have any rights under that kind of circumstance? And
who are the dissenters?
Right. How do you determine that first? And then at the same time, is there any kind of protection that could be afforded to those, to the ownership of that land?
Let's try. Those are critical questions. First.
Do you want to pull the mic over?
Yes. If we have to distinguish between two possible scenarios of Alaska's substantive law. That which is the current Alaska law is in Article 5 of the existing Alaska Corporations Code, which we've had in place essentially since 1957. Right? Should the legislature enact what was last year, Senate Bill 246, the law would change. under the existing Alaska law, let's first talk about the question of a mortgage. A mortgage is within the prerogative of the board of directors, and they have no need to go to shareholders. If the mortgage, lease, exchange, or pledge, or other disposition of all or substantially all of the property and assets of a corporation is made in the regular course of business. Now, it would depend, therefore, on what it was that the board was getting in exchange. You had indicated that they were trying to raise liquid cash for the purpose of developing assets. Right. Boards normally take the position that if that is what they are attempting to do, they are within the area of pursuing the regular course of business and that they have authority to do it and that that type of thing is not an organic change. If a mortgage under the existing Alaska law is not in the regular course of business, then it would fall under Section 438, not Section 435, and there would have to be shareholder authorization because that would be treated as an organic change. If it was a Section 435 transaction in which they had not gone to the shareholders and there was no shareholder vote, under Alaska law there would be no dissenter's rights, because the only way you can become a dissenter under Alaska law is to have, first of all, the board obliged to put the issue to the shareholders, recognizing it as an organic change, and you become a dissenter by going to that meeting in person or in proxy and voting no on the question. That's the first thing you have to do. If you don't vote, you can't become a dissenter. You had to vote no. And thereafter, within 30 days, you must make a demand upon the corporation that it pay you the fair market value of your shares. If you don't make the demand within 30 days, you forfeit what had been your rights. Now, this is just going through the scenario of what is existing Alaska state law. Corporation is obliged to pay you that sum of money or to make a counteroffer and to negotiate with you. You have 90 days in which to conclude that negotiation. If it is successful, they pay you the sum of money you negotiate out of them. If not, the matter goes to court. Corporation is obliged to go to court and pay the legal expenses of commencing an action to determine the fair market value of the dissenter's rights. And then the object is to bring all of the dissenters into that one judicial shootout so that whatever is ascertained to be the value is the sum which is paid to every shareholder, just multiply the number of shares which she has. So that's the scenario. Is there any protection if the corporation is on the verge of failure in that scenario? None whatsoever. None. Right? Although the statute does not indicate it, it is pretty well, I don't know of any deviation from this when the point has been put to courts in other jurisdictions, that the rights of bona fide third-party creditors always take precedence over the rights of equitable owners, whether those equitable owners had in the interregnum dissented or not. And so we can't look to these areas of corporate law as a protection of the lands of a corporation against the specter of what would be the corporate obligation of creditors. Now, I can't speak to the land bank that you're discussing as whether it's good or bad. I don't know whether the land bank gives you some sort of strong-arm legal protection, but I can tell you that the basic concept of a sale of assets and the fact that there are or are not dissenters' rights is currently a matter of state law, and whether or not that's some sort of trump card to say to the creditor, aha, you're really not going to be able to get our corporate assets because we're paying them over to all of our dissenting shareholders. Well, you would have had to have all the shareholders vote no, in which case you would never have authorized the transaction, in which case it would be an ultra vires transaction, which is another, I mean, it's so crazy to be talking about these very basic human problems in Latin terms. I mean, it gives you some dimension of what it was when this idea of making these corporate problems arose. One change that you ought to be aware of, should the legislature have passed HB 343, Senate Bill 246 in the last legislature, there would have been more discretion to the board of directors. A mortgage of corporate assets would never have been treated. In other words, whether it was, quote, in the usual course of business or not in the usual course of business under the new Alaska Corporations Code pending in the old legislature, and it was not enacted last time, the mortgage would be a business decision for the board to make. You wouldn't have to go to the shareholder, so that there would be no possibility of dissenters' rights unless the articles of the corporation set a higher standard wherein dissenters' rights would trigger in. But again, even under the new ACC provisions, there would have been no enhanced margin of protection for the corporate assets against the claims of bona fide creditors.
Tony?
They, the next the follow-up of that is this hypothetical corporation who's in this dire straits. What can they do? I mean, they're stuck with having mortgaged all of their lands. They're and they're in a position now of not having any money to pay their creditors, and they don't want to have to lose all their land. The shareholders don't want to lose the land. I mean, it seems to me then the only possible option they have is to merge. Find some big brother to merge with.
Yes, the failing corporation in that circumstance then becomes an object of a race of creditors. Those who hold the mortgage are protected because they have the prior right. They have a lien upon the mortgaged land. The unsecured creditors are going to take a bath under your scenario. They're not going to get anything at all. The way you try and hold off the creditor who otherwise is going to foreclose on the mortgage is to convince them not to, and the way you normally convince them not to is just what you suggested. You go to some other entity and say, if this entity puts its assets on the line so that you can now look to that, we can either say that the consolidated or the merged corporation will be viable, in which case you won't foreclose because we've solved the problem of insolvency, we're solvent once again, or we've got somebody to come along and act as a guarantor. But I suppose at that point Rosemary's Village Corporation would become very friendly with the regional corporation and would be racing there saying, you know, would you like to help bail us out of a situation
would
like
you
this?
Like to see 14
and I have another slightly a follow-up is and this might make a regional corporation a lot more friendly towards its village corporation in its region, is what happens if the regional corporation is not responsive? Does that village corporation, this hypothetical village corporation, have an option of going to another regional corporation outside of its region and saying, I need help? And I think somebody else, somebody who's more familiar with ANCSA would be able to. My thinking is that they can do that, but it just presents political problems.
Bart Garber?
Tony, I think you could ask anybody you want to do. It depends on what you've got to sell. Your own region, like has been alluded to, may be interested in something because they have a subsurface estate that's close to it. And so you may be able to sell some right there if there's anything at all caught up in 14F. But otherwise, you know, what interest does anyone else have in dealing with your problem?
Yeah, you're alluding to saying that the corporation which I've talked about, a hypothetical corporation which I've talked about, has any existence in any part of the state, and I don't claim that it does. I'm just stating that I'm talking about the stuff that was mentioned earlier. What about 20,000 or 2011? What can we do? What can a corporation faced with that circumstance do immediately, barring any kind of change? So I don't want to allude to any village corporation right now.
Gary, just
let me give you a different situation. Let's suppose that a village corporation has some financial problems and there is a potential takeover or forced sale of a portion of land. The subsurface estates, I guess, are marketable or alienable to an outside interest, but the surface estate has been placed in some kind of trust, whether it's with an IRA or a cooperative or a native association. This is a question that really deals with the integrity of the land base that's being set aside. On one hand, you seem to be talking as though once it's put in the hands of some protective entity, it's safe from forced development by an outside entity, whether it's a regional corporation or a non-native business. And I get the impression that that might not be the case. And earlier on, Justice Berger, you mentioned the possibility of potential swaps of land between village corporations and regional corporations so that the village corporation might be able to acquire a land base that maintain both the subsurface and the surface estates. I'd like to hear some discussion about that.
Well, hi, Bart.
I can only talk because I happen to be in a village corporation that might have some surface estate that might even be worth anything. And even when you're in that situation, you've got to understand that the region has all of the subsurface below you anyway. And unless there's something that they're real interested in keeping sole protection over in one area, I really don't know that there's going to be much chance of us striking a bargain. But you know, there's other situations of these other hypothetical villages that the surface estate may have an extraordinary value that might be exchanged for, hopefully, on the part of the region, I guess, subsurface estate that has no value. That's the only way I could see it.
Roland Shanks?
Well, I think part of the problem is that until we actually get shaken out what is subsurface and what is surface and how big 14F is and how little 14F might be, it's very difficult to think about how you'd structure something like that. Realistically, a worst case scenario for the village, 14F is just downtown. The villages may not have much interest in gaining surface rights. There may not be a lot in it for them. Worst case scenario for the region's 14F is the entire village selection area, in which case there may be a lot of interest. There have been village and regional corporations who have actively talked about trading parts of the subsurface for surface and essentially creating two pieces of property that are separated, vertically instead of horizontally. And my hunch is that once these problems of what is included in each estate are actually start to get settled out, that we'll see some of that actively happen, because it's obviously one of the easier ways to get around the 7I problems and some other problems is to do that kind of thing.
Could I come back to the point that I thought we had reached about 30 minutes ago when we were about to consider Resolution 84-08? And could I ask, it seemed to me that the issue it raised was one that we should take up with these legal experts while they're here. That is, if a native corporation transfers its land to a non-profit or a co-op or an IRA, what advantages are gained thereby? I think we should discuss that. And I thought we should also consider the present procedural problems, if that's the right word, that stand in the way.
This is a using your three goals, protect from corporate failure, protect from takeover, and protect from property taxation with regard to the real estate held by corporations, whether it's surface or subsurface estates. Nonprofit corporations and cooperative corporations are corporations under the law of Alaska. Therefore, they have about them the attribute of limited liability. They have some very different features, however, that you're embracing. The biggest distinction between a profit-seeking corporation, which is what all of the ANCSCA corporations that are at the regional level are, and I understand there's a dispute as to whether it's merely the vast majority or all of the village corporations, and nonprofit corporations, which were an alternative extended under the Settlement Claims Act to village corporations, that they could be nonprofit if they wanted to. The basic idea there is the whole notion that you would gain some enhanced protection against alienation, because you have a greater ability to define the qualities and characters of who can be members of membership-oriented nonprofit corporations. You have, however, a trade-off for that in that you are unable to make any form of direct distribution of the fruits of the enterprise to the members, whereas you can make direct distributions in the form of dividends in cash or in kind to shareholders in a profit-seeking corporation.
Excuse me, Dan. You're lumping what are called non-profit corporations and cooperatives together. There's no distinction for.
Oh no, I haven't even begun to speak to cooperatives
okay.
yet, because they are deserving of yet another type of treatment.
Right.
Insofar as what the basic thing that you would notice in your life if you suddenly took a corporation and transformed it into a nonprofit corporation, right? You would have a choice between what are called public benefit nonprofits and mutual benefit nonprofits, and it is clear that you would opt for what are called mutual benefit nonprofits. A public benefit nonprofit would be an outfit like the Community Chest that is intended for some charitable or eleemosynary purpose, doesn't even have members, has a self-perpetuating board of directors. A mutual benefit nonprofit is organized not for everybody in the society, but for a certain group of people. And it is run, according to Mr. Bass, very much like a profit-seeking corporation. And with that generalization, some mental reservations aside, I would generally concur. Biggest distinction is you cannot make any type of distribution to the individual members. So they can't look forward to ever receiving any kind of a dividend check if you've opted to organize as a mutual benefit nonprofit. Does it mean that you can't ever get any advantage out of being a member of a mutual benefit nonprofit? No. The theory is that the mutual benefit nonprofit is providing a battery of services to you, and its cost structure for providing those battery of services, since it doesn't have the element of having to pay dividends to beneficial owners, will be lower, and that is your basic economic benefit for affiliating with a mutual benefit nonprofit corporation. Are you immunized from corporate failure? No. You have no greater immunization from corporate failure than a profit-seeking venture would have. Again, bona fide third-party creditors will always have the prior claim on corporate assets over members' claims. But you can define members in such a way that makes it harder for there to be a takeover. Although I would point out that even for profit-seeking corporations, under the corporation law that was pending in the last legislature, a corporation is competent by its articles to define the attributes and qualities and qualifications for shareholders. So you can have lots of protection there, and clearly do that in a mutual benefit nonprofit. Are the interests in a mutual benefit nonprofit alienable? All right. There is a greater tendency to respect the right to restrict alienation of memberships in mutual benefit nonprofits. Not terribly edifying, but very common group are snobby country clubs that form themselves as mutual benefit nonprofits, and they're very, very interested in who's going to be there, whether they'll wear the right clothes, etc. So there are certain advantages. And those advantages sound most likely in protection from takeover and a greater opportunity to select who will be the members. Are you protecting your property from taxation? Not as a mutual benefit nonprofit corporation. They pay taxes just like everybody else. Public benefit nonprofits generally are exempt from taxation, but mutual benefit nonprofits never are. So a country club pays assets, it pays taxes on its gross income, it pays taxes upon its real estate, et cetera. So that's the essential choice to be made with nonprofit entities. Now, cooperatives. Alaska has one of the most skeletal cooperative statutes on the face of the earth, all right? I mean, you'd get a better reading of the weather by walking into a cave and just sitting there for 6 months and guessing, then you're going to get a reading of your future by chartering your future under the skeletal provisions of Alaska's Cooperative Corporation Statute. You can count both of the major judicial decisions on your nostrils in terms of figuring out whether the court has gone along and sort of filled in the gaps. It hasn't. So we don't know much about cooperatives, but I can give you sort of a clue as to what they look like. A cooperative is the most insulated from takeover of any entity because there's no stock. And the membership in a cooperative, if it does choose to have stock, the stock is virtually meaningless. It carries with it no voting rights. You can restrict the membership in cooperatives, and cooperatives are very, very useful because in dealing with the members of the cooperative, cooperatives have been used to discipline various aspects of the economy. So if you belong to a fishing cooperative and you get in trouble with that cooperative, you're in real trouble because they have rights to your catch that are defined by contracts, and there are provisions in state law that say no matter how unreasonable, no matter how one-sided those contracts, the member is bound. So cooperatives have been used in other states and to a limited extent in Alaska, primarily to make it possible for certain individuals in certain areas of agricultural endeavor to organize themselves as either production or marketing co-ops. Alaska's statute, as I say, compared to those of other states, is in desperate need of serious attention. The Alaska Code Revision Commission at the present time is undertaking a look at the Alaska Cooperative Statute, and if the AFN is interested in that area, I would urge you to engage that body in dialogue because they're right now looking at it. A co-op gives you no protection from failure. A cooperative can belly up just as dead as can a mutual benefit nonprofit or a profit-seeking corporation. Has considerable protection from takeover. Has no exemption from taxation. Right. So there's no entity out there that I'm aware of, unless we can get one created, that is Cinderella's carriage, that you can just hop into and be assured that you will be whisked away to a lovely evening. They can all turn into a pumpkin on you if the business turns out to come a cropper, in which case you can't reverse the process, at least unknown to me how it's done.
Glenn.
I'd like to explore a little more this cooperative. I don't know if you were here when I explained. Now, I'm coming from a native. We talk here, everybody's got an input, which is good. From a native standpoint of saving the land, my idea was, can a corporation that now exists, my company, my corporation, take that land and put it into another, like a cooperative, to protect it? Can I do that legally under state statutes?
Yes.
As it exists now.
You clearly could, with the exception that I would suggest to you that taking the land from your village corporation and conveying it to a cooperative corporation would be treated under existing Alaska law as an organic change, so you'd have to have the consent of your shareholders.
Correct.
Right? And once that it was in that cooperative, it would be insulated in the sense that however you define the cooperative's membership could keep that cooperative's membership comprised of natives and exclude non-natives. If you ever were so foolish as to get that cooperative to join in and guaranteeing any loans made to the corporation, the minute you take the assets that are in the cooperative and have the cooperative become a guarantee party to the transaction, there's no longer any safe harbor for those assets. I mean, they're now committed. So the one way you could do it, Glenn, that you can keep the land away from rapacious creditors is never enter into any transaction
right.
wherein the land is pledged to rapacious creditors.
Okay. How do you do that? By lease agreement. What I'm saying is, now we're in the right track here, I think. If I took this land and if I wanted to make a business, say 1,000 acres of timber, my idea was to go back to a membership and say, I want to take 1,000 acres and make it into a corporation, profit corporation. Can that be done?
Certainly. In other words, can the cooperative later on form a profit-seeking corporation? Can the same individuals, the same beneficial owners, form a profit-seeking corporation and convey assets from the cooperative to the profit-seeking corporation? They can.
See.
But in other words, you can have more than one corporate entity and you can move assets around, but at some point in the real world, if you want to go out and borrow $1 million and they say, well, what do you got? And you say, well, we don't have much of anything because it's all in the co-op. They'll say, well, then we'd like to speak to the officers of the co-op. And at some point, you'll be backed into a corner, and the people who have the ability to sign over the major assets will be asked to do so. And at that point, I wouldn't want to leave you with the impression that the assets are insulated. They wouldn't be. And you can't have it, as somebody said earlier today, can you have it both ways, where the assets can be effectively used to leverage yourself into a cash liquidity situation?
I tell you where I'm coming from. Yeah. I'm very leery of IRAs because of the federal government in itself. You take sovereignty question in the state of Alaska. I mean, we would have an uprise in the state of Alaska if we were given that immunity. And I, as a citizen of the United States, would go against that.
Yes.
What we ought to be, and that's why I'm saying how to protect this land. Maybe what we ought to be talking about is dealing with the federal government before it goes to court on these sovereignty questions. I mean, we have 200 little villages out there going to be a nation. Now, the state of Alaska cannot, and the United States cannot, in my mind, deal with this. I mean, all of a sudden, I'm from Georgetown, a little village of 35 people. If I have a sovereign right, I can say to you, you can't come into my, I'm a sovereign nation. Well, that's asinine, you know. That is absolutely asinine to me. That until that question is dealt with and clarified from Congress or from the courts, I'd be very hesitant to put my land into an IRA for that reason, because Congress can pull that thing down on you, and what do you have? Nothing.
How do you feel about IRAs, Professor Fessler?
Well, I'll give you an idea of how stupid I was. For the first five times I heard that, I thought you meant those individual retirement accounts. And there is a sense in which that's exactly what you mean, only you're arriving at it through a very different mechanism. Now, I don't know enough about Indian Reorganization Act to begin.
Well, I thought that, in fact, we would come to that tomorrow. It's getting on toward 4, and I'd like to carry on this discussion this afternoon for a little while and then tomorrow, because I think it really is the guts of what everybody's concerned about.